you need a title or some idea. And I saw a box in the garage of Dylan's sounds.
We wrote 10 songs in 10 days, which is unbelievable. It's unheard of, really.
Yeah, well, it began slowly. We were all in the same area. I think Jeff was probably the catalyst for George and myself and Roy Orbison being around. Jeff had been after Roy Orbison for ages.
Welcome to Revolution 2
through 8.
I am your host, Zach, and with me is...
Dylan. Hello.
Hello. On the last episode, we alluded to we are going to cover The Traveling Wilburys, Volume 1. A few corrections. I alluded to some songs that did not show up on Traveling Wilburys Volume 1. Traveling Wilburys Volume 1, we're going to speak on it in just a second, but before I want to put some like business of current events that have happened. So in between recordings, we've had a few major artists pass away. We had Sly Stone of Sly and the Family Stone, and we also had Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys. We know we already have a very good direct like line to Brian Wilson, even through like session musicians, because I think there is an artist that played like a instrument that was on Pet Sounds that I think was on like a George Harrison record. It might be on this record.
Oh, sure.
We will probably touch upon Pet Sounds in about 3 episodes, we think, because we feel it is a pretty interesting album to cover. I mean, everyone's covered it, so we probably won't have anything interesting to say about it.
We're missing the bandwagon a little bit, but that's all right.
Yeah, we wanted to cover it because of how much Paul likes it. I'm a big fan of it myself. So, do you have any other business to share before we move on?
I just wanted to shout out and thank everybody who's been interacting with us so far and watching like the YouTube shorts and listening to us on the different platforms. It's really nice to see that engagement, and we hope you're all having a lovely time with us.
Agreed. We just released the second episode on Two Virgins, and I don't know if another weird current event. There's been a controversy about a cover art in recent modern music with Sabrina Carpenter. Little do people know that if they went back and they looked at Two Virgins cover, they'd be like, wow, that Sabrina Carpenter record, I don't know. I mean, Two Virgins is very unsexy compared to the Sabrina Carpenter cover. We're not going to go much further in that because we don't want
to. Maybe there's room to talk about other albums that have been banned in certain jurisdictions because of their album art.
Ooh, that'd be fun. That'd be a good idea for another one. So, are you ready to move into Traveling Wilburys Volume 1?
I am ready. Let's talk about this.
So, we alluded to that George Harrison was in this band. We lied to you. He actually isn't in this band. There is a person that looks like him, sounds like him. This is not part of the Paul is Dead conspiracy. There's a guy named Nelson Wilbury who looks like George Harrison. There's a guy named Otis Wilbury that looks like Jeff Lynne of ELO. More on that in just a second. Then there's a guy named Lefty Wilbury that looks like Roy Orbison. So there's a guy named Charles T. Wilbury Jr. that looks like Tom Petty. And then there's this guy named Lucky Wilbury who looks like Bob Dylan.
It's the darndest thing.
Okay, we're joking. So these are all the members of Traveling Wilburys. So this is a super group. This is a hangout group. We'll go a little bit into the backstory just a little bit about it. But just first thing to know is that all five of these men that we just mentioned are friends. And this is a very serendipitous album of how it came to be. It really just starts with George Harrison's like, we should go do something. And then they pick up random people.
It's very interesting. Just very natural and organic.
Mm-hmm. So let's go through this. So do you know who George Harrison is?
Sorry. For a moment, I thought you were asking the viewer. Do I know who George Harrison is? Yes. He is a Beatle. He is the shy one. He is a songwriter who was not featured as frequently as the Lennon-McCartney writing duo.
And what's really important about this era of George Harrison is that he actually, before this record, had only released like one album in like the last 10 years, really, which was Cloud Nine. Actually, he's been quite successful recently being a movie producer, surprisingly. That's actually what he's mostly been doing in the 80s is producing films, working a lot with Monty Python. There's Monty Python connections in the liner notes of this album where different members of Monty Python wrote some of the liner notes for this. And most importantly, we get a connection to the first person and maybe the most important person, in my opinion, of this whole group for how this group sounds in Jeff Lynne. What do you know about Jeff Lynne? Because I know you know a lot.
I wouldn't say I know a lot about Jeff Lynne. What I would say is that I really, really like the band that Jeff Lynne was in, which rhymes. And that's ELO, or the Electric Light Orchestra.
And for people that don't know, that's where the Chess ELO comes from.
The ELO rating is how you know, the top ELO rating, the best person at chess, better than Bobby Fischer, better than Magnus Carlsen, Kasparov, Gotham Chess, all of them idiots compared to Jeff Lynne.
And they love when you call it ELO. They love it. They love it.
So yeah. I wanna put this out in the beginning because I feel like I waited too long towards the end of the last episode to get thoughts and true feelings and opinions on things out. I really like ELO, and there are some songs on this album that sound very much like Lost or alternate universe ELO tracks. Not all of them, but in looking into this, I and Zach looked at a couple of different albums that Jeff Lynne had produced during this period, because that's mainly what he was doing, was producing.
Okay, here's all the things that I listened to that he had a hand in at this period of time. Cloud Nine, George Harrison, 1987. Full Moon Fever, Tom Petty, 1989. Into the Great Wide Open, Tom Petty, 1991. It's a little bit out of our scope, but it's still important. Still major collaboration. Armchair Theater, which is his record, Jeff Lynne, in 1990. Mystery Girl, Roy Orbison, in 1990. And all of what you're hearing on Traveling Wilburys is him and George producing most of this.
What did I listen to? I listened to a couple of tracks off of the 1984 Everly Brothers album that I didn't realize existed and didn't realize that Jeff Lynne was a part of.
Oh, really?
Do you know anything about the Everly Brothers?
Not really.
We will have opportunities to talk about the Everly Brothers in more detail, but this would be another group that my grandma listened to a lot before the Beatles came around. They recorded things like the original version of Love Hurts and kind of contemporaries with Ricky Nelson and the like. So yeah, the 1984 Everly Brothers album, at least a few tracks off of it. I listened to a few tracks off of Cloud Nine. I listened to a little bit of Brian Wilson's 1988 album, and that was the day before he passed away. So I'm hoping that wasn't, I don't know, bad juju on my part. And I listened to the 1990s Beatles singles, Free as a Bird and Real Love, that were not produced by George Martin, but were instead produced by Jeff Lynne.
Oh, I didn't know that. Really interesting.
When we eventually tackle Anthology, we'll get to discuss that more. I wanted to listen to some more of his work as a producer to kind of compare it to this and to compare it to ELO to answer one burning question. Does Jeff Lynne always sound like that? Does every Jeff Lynne song sound like a Jeff Lynne song?
Yes. I think a lot of the Jeff Lynne produced stuff sounds extremely similar, to the point where when I go to the Tom Petty, some of the Tom Petty songs where I'm like, oh, yeah, like there's at times where I'm like, oh, am I finding like hidden Tom Petty tracks, especially on the volume three? But we were not talking about volume three today.
So if you are in the same position as me, where you're already a big fan of ELO and their sound, this is an absolute win because everything sounds like that. You're going to find a lot of new tracks that you will enjoy listening to. If you don't, or if you crave more musical, we'll call it creativity or variance, you might not be as satisfied with the sound of this record, I could see.
And one thing I want to mention about the sound of this record, but this record to me kind of works because I think adult contemporary was still kind of a viable genre and could chart. And like, we're about to get into the country music craze of the 90s as well, where this album kind of, when you think about it coming out in 88, doesn't really sound a lot like anything else that I know of from 88. So I went and listened to some stuff from that period of time as well as an additional research. Acid House was popular. not going to tell you much what Acid House is, but I listened to Technique by New Order. And then I listened to a rap album by Public Enemy, and that came out in 1988, called It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. And that sounds nothing. Both of those records sounds nothing like what we're going to listen to on this record at all, which is so weird because how uniform everything that we mentioned that Jeff Lynne produces at this period of time sounds extremely similar. And I think a person that really pushed Jeff Lynne to want to produce is that Jeff Lynne loved an artist from way, way back named Roy Orbison.
Roy Orbison is a super interesting guy. He has connections to Harrison going back to the early 60s. The first time Roy Orbison toured England, he was co-headlining with the Beatles. Originally.
Really?
Yes. Originally, he was supposed to be like just the star. It was Roy Orbison and these guys the Beatles can come along and play too. And, you know, that's common even today, right? You'll have a big act You'll have an opening act, and maybe someday the opening act will get really big. And then you can say, I knew them when.
Recently, I went to a Kendrick Lamar and SZA concert where they co-headlined it. It was a very even split on both.
This was a little more kind of split down the middle, as I understand it, where Roy Orbison would play one set and then the Beatles would play the second set. Wasn't intended that way, but because Beatlemania in England was on the rise, this was, I think, earlier, mid-1963, people wanted Beatles, so they both got to share the limelight. That was an interesting connection to learn about. Roy Orbison, probably best known these days for the track Pretty Woman. That's probably, like, especially younger listeners, if they're going to know anything by Roy Orbison, it's probably going to be that. But he was big in sort of the late 50s to early 60s, kind of a contemporary with Elvis and that style of rock and roll.
And they even, like, during the recording of this, asked him stories about Elvis. Out of all of the members of the group, this is probably the one member of the group that the other members of the group were most in awe of.
Oh gosh, I didn't realize Elvis had been dead for 10 years at the time that this record was recorded. Wow.
So Roy Orbison, for me, what I know about him is that I know You Got It. I think that might be the only other song that people might know.
Which was his final single that was released after he had already passed away.
Yeah, his song In Dreams is featured on in Blue Velvet, and one of the a very chilling scene from the David Lynch film from in 1986, which I think made the song come back into the consciousness.
That's cool. I haven't seen that. I'm not super familiar with a lot of David Lynch works, but that's really cool.
Yeah. So the next member of the Traveling Wilburys, Tom Petty. So Tom Petty is, at this point, I think there's a pretty big artist. He had some really big hits in the 80s.
With the Heartbreakers.
Yeah, with the Heartbreakers. He's about to go on a very lucrative two-album experience where he's going to make Full Moon Fever, which is going to have some really big hits. It's going to have Free Falling, Don't Back Down, and then he reunites with the Heartbreakers, but have Jeff Lynne produce it and makes Into the Great Wide Open, which is another good song. Tom Petty, I listened to his Greatest Hits album a lot as a kid, so I am kind of familiar with a lot of his work. He's amazing job on this record. He's really interesting. It's also interesting when we talk about the musicalness is that he... Do you have any thoughts about Tom Petty?
I'm probably the least familiar with Tom Petty out of all of the artists here. You know, kind of that Heartland rock sound, I think I've heard him tagged as. So I'm familiar with some of his really big hits. He seems like a really just kind of chill guy, basically.
Yeah.
And he adds a good sound to the record. No complaints about Tom Petty for me.
And he seems like the most recent George friend because he came over and toured, I think in 86 or something. He came over and toured and they connected over their love of 50s rock music and yeah, became very quick friends.
And I believe that is as good a segue as any into Bob Dylan, because the Heartbreakers, as I understand it, were backing Dylan during this time when he was touring. Bob Dylan is I suppose you could say he's from the Heartland as well. You know, he's a very folksy singer. Some would argue, my grandmother and my wife would definitely argue, that he's not much of a singer to begin with. He has a very unique sound. It might not be to your taste. What most people will agree with is that he is a poet. He is a great lyricist. Even if you don't like a Bob Dylan recording, there's a good chance that you're going to like a cover of a Bob Dylan song. You know, Jimi Hendrix with All Along the Watchtower.
Not Knocking on Heaven's Door.
Yep, Knocking on Heaven's Door. Guns N' Roses.
Bob Dylan is an interesting guy. Bob Dylan has a very bizarre place in my life because Tangled Up in Blue is one of my Mount Rushmore songs. Like, it is a song that I've liked since I was a little baby to now. I love that song, and I've grown to love it more.
If you had a desert island disc that was the only songs you could listen to for the rest of your life, Tangled Up in mm-hmm. Blue, you think would be on there.
Yeah, and that album that it comes from, Blood on the Tracks, that starts a very bizarre trend where people who critics say this was Bob Dylan's best album since Blood on the Tracks. And Bob Dylan is not in a great commercial or critical period of his career. And also, going back to Tom Petty also wasn't necessarily in a great critical or commercial period of his career. And this kind of helps relaunch it.
Bob Dylan, of course, friends with the Beatles for, you know, many years, since 64, 65, kind of their first couple of trips to the U.S. You know, it's long been understood or said that Bob Dylan turned them on to drugs, marijuana.
But yeah, that's Bob Dylan. And that creates this group of people. And there's a few session musicians. Like, there is a guy by the name of Jim Keltner. We also have some additional people with, like, Jim Horn and Ray Cooper who show up on this. But Jim Keltner will be the one that will be in the music videos. We'll talk about that. So when you combine all these people, like Voltron, you get a supergroup. This is the Traveling Wilburys. It's supergroup. Should we explain the concept of what a supergroup is?
Very briefly, because they've fallen out of fashion, I think, in the last 20, 30, 40 years. So a supergroup is basically any band where every member of the band, or at least the vast majority of them, have been successful either as solo artists in their own right or as part of another band. The Traveling Wilburys might not be the most famous example, but they were really big. The other ones that immediately come to mind are, there was a country supergroup called The Highwaymen, which was Johnny Cash, Waylon Jennings, Willie Nelson, and Kris Kristofferson. The other really big one would be Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young, who had all come from different bands.
There's also Asia, if you're into lame progressive rock music in the 80s. There's some good songs on the first Asia record, but it is for John Wetton, Chris Squire. Oh yeah, like Carl Palmer's on that record. They could have done better. It is a dorky sounding. It's almost Kansas level of lame.
Was Emerson, Lake, and Palmer a super yes. group, or is that how Palmer got big?
I think Palmer was doing some stuff, yeah. Because, like, you have Keith Emerson, who was in The Nice, and that they were lightly successful. Then you have Greg Lake, who was in King Crimson, and then you have Carl Palmer, who was doing some other stuff. He's a drummer. Drummers get around. Like, if we did every session with drummer, and we just tried to do really weird little adventures of, oh, this drummer played with this, and it's like, you're opening the door. Like, this Jim Keltner, we literally can listen to almost any band at this point, because Jim Keltner has been on an insane amount. The same with, like, Roy Cooper.
Ray Cooper is super prolific. I've seen Ray Cooper in concert.
I have too.
Backing Elton John. He is, you know, very good at his craft and well-respected among musicians. A couple of things that contrast this record pretty severely with the other records we've listened to. Accessibility. With Two Virgins, we talked about how it's very lo-fi. You could pretty much make that album in an afternoon if you wanted mm-hmm. to. It's very, very punk, very put it out there. To some extent, the Beatles were seen that way by a lot of people, because a lot of popular musicians at that time were, you know, very handsome or pretty people from the States. And here you've got these kind of average looking blokes from a dock working town in England. And a lot of people tuned in and said, wait, if they can make it as musicians, I can too. So both the Beatles and Two Virgins felt very accessible. There's nothing accessible about a supergroup. You probably don't have five friends who are superstars in their own right. Maybe you do. Good for you. I certainly don't.
I'm trying to think of like in a modern context. So it'd probably be like if... So a supergroup now that I could think of, like Taylor Swift, Ed Sheeran, Kendrick Lamar, Chaperone. And then you have the old fogey. Well, I guess like Bob Dylan also old, but Roy Orbison feels older because he actually had hits in the 50s. It would be like Justin Timberlake.
Oh, God. I think you're right.
Yeah. JT hasn't really had a lot of big hits recently, nor did Roy Orbison. And I think that's why Jeff Lynne was so excited to work with Roy Orbison. And yeah, let's just go to what started this.
Let's talk about Handle With Care.
Yes, the first single and one of the good reasons why this album exists.
So before we talk about the musicality, we have to talk about how did these amazing people get together. Like Zach said, Cloud Nine had just come out. And this is what George Harrison said. In the UK and in the European markets, it was common, more common so there than here, to put out like an extended single, to put out like a 12-inch single rather than like a 7-inch. We're talking about the days of vinyl records here, folks. And like I mentioned in Beatles 1, a lot of times, especially in the UK, stuff would end up on singles that maybe wasn't destined for the albums, particularly with B-sides. George needed to record something to stick on the end of it. He happened to be having dinner with Jeff Lynne, the producer of Cloud Nine, and Roy Orbison was there also, because Jeff was working with him on Mystery Girl. And George is talking about, yeah, I got to make this new song. So I don't know, Jeff, if you want to, you know, figure it out with me, that'd be cool. I don't know where we're going to find recording space in a short period of time, but we got to get this done. And Roy Orbison just very sweetly is like, oh, well, if you end up doing anything, you know, I'd love to sit in and listen. And George is thinking, okay, well, if Roy Orbison's coming, there's no way in heck we're just letting him sit there. I'm going to have to write a part for him. So he's got that in the back of his mind. And he knows that Bob Dylan is available. He calls him, says, hey, you've got a studio in your garage. Can we come by, record a track, just borrow it for a day? And Bob says, yeah, sure. Okay, great. So that's settled. George has to go pick up his guitar from Tom Petty's house. Tom Petty's like, yeah, I'll come along too. So now you've got all these people together and they're going to make a song together. The short of it is the record executive said, this is too good to be a B-side to a single no one's going to hear. No, absolutely not. We're not releasing it like that. So George is sitting on this until such a time that he can get the gang back together and record a full album, which is fascinating.
It's recorded in L.A. at Dan Stewart's house, one of the members of the Rhythmics, because he had a studio. That's where the rest of the album will be recorded. It'll be mixed in England, but let's go to Handle Me With Care. Do you agree with the record executive that this song was too good to just release as a B-side?
110%. I really enjoy this song.
It's a classic. If you've never heard this song, I think you should go out of your way to listen to it. It is arguably the best song on this album. I think that accomplishes the vision of this kind of pseudo group that they're eventually going to create, because this song has everybody apart. Everyone's in it. Everybody has like a very, like a major contribution to the chorus. The verses of this song are George Harrison, and George Harrison just has a great voice. We haven't really been able to talk about him all that much except for like something, but every song that he has on this record, I think he's great on every time we hear his voice, and that's true for everybody. But I think the one thing that always catches you out of left field, or at least for me when I was listening, is Roy Orbison and his lead up to the major part of the chorus. I don't know how you feel.
If Roy Orbison hadn't gone the rock and roll path, I swear he could have had a career in opera or something. His voice is strong. It is beautiful. He has such an incredible range. I did go back and listen to a bunch of older Roy Orbison records to compare, to see, like, you know, basically he's still got it. Like, he sounds just as good in 1988 as he did in 1963. It's incredible.
Yeah, no, he's almost at a point where it'd be interesting if he was more used as like a session musician, as like a voice, like somebody just to write for him. And I'm just surprised that not a lot more people thought, oh, this is a good voice let's write more music for him. Because he's a voice where I would be really intrigued, like, if we would have had some more weirder art stuff, like, with him, like, maybe some synth stuff with him would have been kind of fascinating, because he has such an interesting voice where I think they even said that you have to write a Roy Orbison song. You can't.
Yes.
Really, you can't really have a Roy Orbison can't just come in, because Roy Orbison has a particular way of doing things, enunciating things, and how he does it. And no, I think he's absolutely excellent. It's such a sad time that on volume three that he's not on it, and that right when he has this big comeback, because he, for those who do not know, he passes away right when the album goes platinum, like only a few weeks before that, and dies in 89. And it would be interesting to see what like a Roy Orbison would do, especially with the country boom, because I would be fascinating what he would add to that space, because I think
with his rockabilly roots,
yeah,
definitely. I would love to also see the alternate universe where we have early 80s synth Orbison. That would be so fascinating.
I think that would be really fun. I think because if you could have some really slow, bizarre, like audio soundscapes that could really, or some like really pretty audio soundscapes to just enhance his voice, because all I really need him is his voice, and it's just great. But yeah, he's so good on this song. I mean, everybody's really good on this song, because what's interesting about this group is that you have George Harrison, who I think is probably the most insular voice of this record. There's not a lot of people that kind of sound like George.
Well, I would argue that, especially in the context of this album, vocally, George Harrison and Jeff Lynne do sound similar. Mm. They sound the most similar to each other compared to anybody else on this record.
Okay, because I also think Jeff Lynne can kind of match with Roy in some ways. Like, they can harmonize pretty decently.
Yes, absolutely.
And Bob and Tom work well together.
Mm-hmm. As kind of that kind of rootsy, kind of bring in that American vibe. Roy Orbison is also American, of course, but bringing that down-to-earth sound to things. This is going to be a little bit of a departure from our previous two episodes in another way, in that this is kind of the first album where we're going to be able to talk about every song, at least in part.
Yeah.
Two Virgins didn't really have songs to discuss.
Mm-hmm.
And the Beatles one was, we made an executive decision too large to discuss all at once. So we mm-hmm. took some highlights.
Yeah, Handle Me With Care is, it's just a great song, the harmonizing on it. Like, even where George was at this point, because also, weird thing, this is, in terms of George being alive, this is the penultimate George recording, because he will only record volume three after this. And then after that, he'll have the posthumous album that will be released.
I didn't realize how little George Harrison not only recorded as a solo artist, but also how little he toured, given that he lived to, I think, the year 2000 or 2001, mm-hmm. thereabouts. He wasn't as prolific as, you know, compared to Paul, mm-hmm. compared to Ringo. Mm-hmm. I think even compared to John, even though John had some slower periods of his solo career, comparing him side by side, mm-hmm. like, I think, you know, given the same lifespan, John would have pumped out a lot more.
He also has the weird thing where one of his first solo records is a triple album as well.
That's true. That's going to be a really difficult one to tackle when we get to it. That might have to be a multi-parter.
I was listening to a wrestling podcast, and they're like, you know, that'd be a perfect record if it was just a single record and not a triple album. I was like, wow, that's weird to listen to a wrestle podcast and they're randomly saying All Things Must Pass.
They were talking about All Things Must Pass on a wrestling podcast.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Want to shout them out? Which podcast was this?
Going in Raw. So the music video is also really good. Did you watch that as well?
Yep. I watched both of the music videos for the two singles off of this album.
Yeah, I like the music video. It kind of captures like the almost spontaneity. I mean, it's literally in a...
I would agree. It's like just filmed in a warehouse, basically.
And we'll talk about the other music video in towards the end, because I adore the final music video. I mean, you get to see smiley Bob Dylan in that particular music video, and that is kind of surreal to see Bob Dylan having a good time, because at this period it just does not seem like this is a man has a good time. Even when we saw Bob Dylan back in the day, which interestingly, the tour he starts after that he's done recording his stuff for this album is that'll be the same tour that we eventually will see him on, like
in like 2009, 2010, somewhere around there, 30 years yeah. after, well, no, 20 years after.
I remember there's a moment in that concert where I think somebody messed up, and I think your grandpa said he was pissed.
They wrote about it in the paper that he was chewing out the piano player, like in the middle of the show. I don't remember that happening.
I don't either.
But the paper wrote about it, so it must be true.
Interesting. Anything else to share about it? This is a hard one because it speaks for itself. I think this song so much. I mean, it's every, like the guitars, the drumming, the harmonizing. It's just excellent. I don't really have many other things to say about it that we will not say later on when we tackle the other song that's kind of like this on this album, which is End of the Line.
It's a good little tune.
Yeah.
Listen to it. Let's move on.
Yeah. All right. So the next song is this the one about I want to do my car?
Yeah, this is I'm in love with my car. No, this is Dirty World. This is a Bob Dylan track. And as mentioned, my wife doesn't care for Bob Dylan very much. She said this track was fine, though. So that's pretty high praise coming from her for a Bob Dylan song.
I do think out of this and the Twitter song, this is probably the better one. If you know, you know. We'll talk about the Twitter song later.
So, yeah, this one, I don't have a tremendous amount to say about it. It's just a guy basically singing a love song. Like we were joking, this is a love song about a car. Bob Dylan singing about how much he likes his car. It doesn't need to be a show car. It doesn't need to win Pebble Beach Concours Restoration. It's a little bit of a beater. That's okay. He loves it anyway. It's just kind of a jaunty little tune. I like it.
There was an interesting thing I saw when I looked at Genius at this earlier today, where we do get to see that maybe there was a different period where they had a different name for the band called Trembling Wilburys instead of Traveling Wilburys.
Yeah, I did wonder about that lyrical choice there.
Yeah.
There's a part at the end of the song where they're basically doing like a round robin. Like they'll sing in chorus, "We love your," and then each of them will say a different thing. The story, which I think they tell in there's like a 25-minute documentary basically on the making of this album that was released as part of the 2007 remaster, and it's available for free on YouTube officially on the Traveling Wilburys channel. So check it out if you get the chance. Basically, they're just like reading random stuff out of like automotive magazines. So they're like, I love your fuel injection. I love your 5-speed gearbox. And then, you know, they're just singing random stuff. I loved your bottled water. It's dumb, but it's fun. It works. I don't know. Maybe I've got low standards. I like it.
I like it better than the next song, which if you go to Genius is one of the least looked at songs on this whole album.
Okay. So Rattled, the third track, basically sounds like an old Sun Records track. Like this really sounds like one of the songs Elvis could have covered in the earliest part of his career.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't have a stomach for kind of early 50s, mid 50s rockabilly, probably not for you. I think it's fine.
But this is a good song to talk about how this album sounds, because this has the percussion that you'll know if you listen to any Jeff Lynne album of this time. If we were better drummers, I mean, I like the drums. They sound good, but this drum sound is just constant throughout of all his other recordings of this time. This is a Jeff Lynne track.
Jeff Lynne sings the lead vocals on this one. So in what way, maybe I wasn't too observant of that in my Jeff Lynne sniffing around. What is distinctive about Jeff Lynne percussion? Tell me.
I think it's just like, it might be a kick drum. There's just like this, like, boom, 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 type of thing.
Okay.
I mean, I'm basically doing the drum of Last Night, because that song is really easy to get caught in your head a little bit. But
sure. I'll have to listen for that. Mm-hmm. On the next go around of Jeff Lynne stuff. Mm-hmm. When I think about the Jeff Lynne sound, it's not so much the percussion that sticks out to me. I wish I was better at like music theory or expressing music, but there's something about the way that like I don't know if you would call it chord sequence or melody, but there's something with the musicality of a lot of ELO tracks and a lot of the 80s Jeff Lynne co-written or ghost-written tracks that, I don't know, I can't put my finger on it, but if you put these songs in a lineup and said, tell me which of these songs was written by Jeff Lynne, I think I could probably do it.
Nice.
The interesting tidbit I'll rip from that mini documentary is that some of the percussion is very improvised and is just them like rubbing their drumsticks on the refrigerator and the kitchen appliances in the kitchen that they're recording this in, because it's five guys with guitars and they have a really small recording studio. So some of this was just recorded in some guy's kitchen, which is crazy.
I think they only had like 9 days to record this. Like every song is like,
yes, because Bob Dylan was gonna go back on tour, so they had basically 9 days to write 9 more songs, and then, you know, Jeff and George went back to England to put the finishing touches on it.
Yeah, so we'll move to the Tom Petty song Last Night. I like it. I think this is, of the last two songs, I prefer it more than the last two songs by quite a bit, but I just like the chorus. It's like Last Night. I think it's fun.
I agree that I like it better than Dirty World and Rattled. Tom Petty just sounds so charming in this song.
And in verse 6, I didn't notice this. It says, now I'm back at the bar. She went a little too far. She done me wrong. All I got is this song.
It's a song of a failed love.
It is. It sounds like people getting murdered because of failed love, or at least getting stabbed. No, I think it's good. I think a lot of Tom Petty's like hits with Jeff Lynne are going to sound kind of like this.
Okay.
But yeah, any other thoughts about this?
No, it's bouncy. It's upbeat. Yeah. It's a lot of fun. I think that's the main takeaway. If you're going to take away one thing about this album, is that it is clear that everybody had fun making it.
Yeah.
And that doesn't always make for a good record, but in this case, it totally does.
Yeah, definitely.
The next song is Not Alone Anymore, which is the last song that Roy Orbison ever recorded as a lead vocalist. I really like this song.
Oh, okay, good.
I think it has a good sound. I'm trying to determine a bias. Do I just like this song because it's the last Roy Orbison song and that's really tragic and it's, you know, sounds nice? Do I like it more because of that? I don't know if I've been able to separate myself from that yet, but I think I would still like it quite a bit, even if that weren't the case.
I'm not the biggest fan of it. I mean, like everything on this album, there is, I think everything is like a 7. There is a 10 out of 10 song on this album that is a perfect song. I think what's interesting in the recording, I was reading up on it, it said that there was a lot more to this song in terms of instrumentation, but they just took away more and more as it went. And like, I think like Tom Petty and Bob, they're like, oh, well, yeah, it's fine.
What I understood from reading and from watching was that there was a completely different instrumental track and nobody was really satisfied with it, and Jeff Lynne came into the night and got his Jeff Lynne fingers all over it, and he took Orbison's vocals and he recorded a completely different audio track, including like different chords. I'm not a musical guy, but if it goes from like C to G to F, like the instrument track that he put down had a completely different chord progression, which radically changed the final sound. I don't know if that original chord progression version still exists. I suspect not, otherwise it might have been released as a bonus track and it wasn't. But this is what we ended up with, and I think it sounds pretty good.
Yeah, I think so too.
Congratulations is next, and I don't like this song at all. For a Bob Dylan song of this era, it's probably one of his better ones. That being said, it comes off as like bitter, bitter ex-boyfriend, bad, nasty, toxic. Oh, you'll come back. Congratulations for making me feel bad. Congratulations for breaking my heart. You don't know what you're missing, babe. You'll come back.
Yeah. And I don't know enough about, like, I haven't listened to enough Bob Dylan records to know. Yeah. Like the lyrics are so serious, where I don't know how serious to take this album, this song. It's a weird one. It does have the weird instrumental bit, that part that is kind of interesting, of where it's kind of more electronic and synthier for some reason. It's interesting.
I feel vindicated because during my multiple listen throughs of this, there were songs that I was very middling on and then I grew to like. Now, to be fair, I think if you listen to any album on repeat enough times, Stockholm Syndrome will take place and you'll like songs that maybe you wouldn't like otherwise. But it never clicked for me with this song, with Congratulations. I feel vindicated because my good friend the Spotify stats agree with me. This is the least placed song on the album.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't mind this one. I actually think I like this song more than you do. I think it's not my favorite. I said it's one of my least favorites, but it's all right.
So now we get to the lost ELO single, Heading for the Light.
It's a good song.
I really like it. I think it sounds good. This is the electric lightest orchestra-ist song on the album, in my opinion.
It's a George-led song. It's also part of this weird, morbid aspect of this album where there's so much death. This is another song, I think, where it's about accepting your life and stuff, like heading for a light, you know. Like, I think George has like a new outlook on life. He's feeling happy, but he also is kind of seeing brighter things. Like, I see the sun ahead. I ain't never looking back. All the dreams are coming true as I think of you. Now there's nothing in the way to stop me heading for the light. And for people that don't know, and we haven't really done a deep dive, George is pretty spiritual. I think, like, when I was reading, he had like a big kind of spiritual epiphany.
I mean, he took to the Eastern mysticism the strongest.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know much about his thoughts or feelings sort of post Beatles, other than he kind of always kept it. And in general, I watched some people that were interviewed like shortly after he passed away, and it sounds like his general outlook was that we're basically all souls and we always exist, past, present, future, and our souls will live on. We're just kind of wearing this body for right now. And like, I think like even within you and without you might kind of touch on that sort of, you know, spiritual aspect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good song. This is one of the ones where it's like, we like this song.
It's just pretty good. Next song has problems or isn't as strong. So track 8 is called Margarita. And while I will maintain Heading for the Light, the most ELO sounding, Margarita might be the second most, but only in the context of, like, you could squeeze this into their early 80s album, Time. I think you could get away with it. It's an instrumental for like a full minute and a half.
We get the horn on this song.
We get the introduction to the horns. Bob Dylan sings for a brief minute. The opening couple of seconds to this song, to me, remind me a lot of You Better You Bet by The Who.
Mm.
I've listened to them back to back, and I feel justified in saying this, that, you know, with this instrumental, I just keep expecting to hear You Better You Better You Bet to come in at any point. And it never does.
I always forget that Bob Dylan sings this song. Like, for me, it's just the beginning of this song, and I'm like, it's an interesting song. It's fun to listen to. I think it's a great song.
No, I don't know that I have the words to describe it. It's not bad.
Mm-hmm.
It's fine. It doesn't detract from the album, but I'm not sure what it adds. The line, went to the Big Apple, took a bite, that's a good line.
According to my analytics, this next song I've listened to the second most, at least according to last week's analytics. And I, for the life of me, the only reason I think this is because the 10th song, I might accidentally press back twice. So I accidentally make it so that this is the song that I listened to the second most on this album. And this is the fabled Tweeter song that we've been talking about this whole time. So this is the Tweeter and the Monkey Man. This is a weird song. Like, if you go on Genius, there is so many things, kind of like footnotes about all of the allusions to Bruce Springsteen, because now that I know they're there, it's almost hard to acknowledge that this is a song and that it's not just like an elaborate version of American Pie. It's like almost American Pie levels of like references to Bruce Springsteen. Like, every line is like a reference to Bruce Springsteen.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like,
I will say the other thing it shares with American Pie is its soul-crushing length. length. This is a long track.
I will fight you on that. American Pie is more interesting as a song. Like, if this did not have a chorus, this song would be almost unbearable at how long how long this song is. This is the longest song on this album.
By far. By like 2 minutes. It's a 5.5 minute song.
And it feels longer than that. Like, it is a strange story. There's a story here if you want to listen to it. Like,
give us the Cliff's Notes.
You have the reference to Born in the USA. Tweeter was a Boy Scout before she went to Vietnam. There is weird arguments on Genius that is Tweeter trans that I saw, because what? I'm like, what is he? Yeah, because Tweeter was a Boy Scout before she went to Vietnam, as he probably would say. And then there's like a part later on. Oh, yeah. So there's a part that says, Jan said the monkey man, I'm not fooled by Tweeter's curl. I knew him long before he ever became a Jersey girl.
Hmm.
I don't know. It's a weird aspect of this song that I did not hear.
Yeah, I didn't catch any of that.
So for people who don't know a lot about The Boss, which I don't think you know a lot about The Boss at all.
I know a couple of his radio hits. I've never done a dive, no.
The Boss is from Jersey, so this song takes place in Jersey. There's stuff about The Boss that I didn't even know that was on here. I know, like, Factory is a reference from Darkness on the Edge of Town. Like, State Trooper, that I think that's a reference to Nebraska. Bruce Springsteen is a big Bob Dylan fan. I mean, he inducts Bob Dylan to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He is the person that speaks for him. He has a really fun way of describing Like a Rolling Stone, where it's like, my mind opened up when I heard Like a Rolling Stone.
I think Springsteen also inducted Orbison into the Hall of Fame.
Oh, really? That'd be interesting to hear, to look at. I like the chorus.
And the walls came down. This is one of those, like I said, Stockholm Syndrome. I didn't jive with this song at all the first time I listened to it.
Uh-huh.
I think it's all right. It's the chorus is super good. This is, aside from the bonus tracks, the song I've listened to the least. And that's just because the way I listen to albums, I'll try to listen to it from the top down. And by the time I get to this, it's like, I don't know, I've got something going on, and so I'm like 2 minutes into Tweeter, and I gotta go do something. But, you know, this is, outside of the singles, the most listened to of the songs on Spotify. So clearly a lot of people are either jiving with it, are trying to dissect the lyrics, or, like me, listen to it halfway, gotta go do something else, and then pick it up again.
I'm happy you mentioned the bonus track, because I actually want to go there next, if that's okay.
I'm good with that.
Maxine, it's fine. It's a George Harrison track.
I'm going to crib notes from Todd in the Shadows, and I am going to use the word inessential to describe both of these tracks. And that's really all I've got.
The other track, Like a Ship, I do like Bob Dylan talking about the Cliffs of Dover. Like, that just amuses me a lot. Bob Dylan, why are you at the Cliffs of Dover? Like, you went out of your way to go to Cliffs of Dover. That's really all I have to say about that.
Like a Ship, I mean, they're both fine. They don't need to be here. It's nice that we're getting, you know, this lost George Harrison track where he's singing lead vocals in Maxine.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really all that's nice about it. It's fine. You know, I'm sure it was meaningful for Jeff and for George's son Danny to go back and overdub it and polish it up. You know, if you're looking for some obscure George Harrison songs to play, this is probably the obscuriest. It's fine.
And if you're looking for one of the greatest George Harrison songs that he had, I think he wrote most of this. It is the final song. And why I really don't, this is the weird thing about when CD reissues happen, is that you sometimes you get these weird added on things that just come in,
ruin the flow.
But you, so if you have to listen to it and you're like, well, this album does have an ender, it has an all-time ender, which is End of the Line. I adore this song. I think this, like, on my re-listen to this, I fell in love with the song again. I don't think I listened to it in a really long time, but I think it's perfect. I think, like, the groove of this song and how it kind of sounds like a train is pretty cool. Tom Petty is just excellent.
Oh, he kills it in his verses.
He just absolutely kills it. Everyone except Bob Dylan, for some reason, gets to sing the chorus, even though he's there.
He sings in the chorus, I think, when everybody's singing, but everybody else gets a feature. George Harrison gets several. Jeff Lynne gets several. Roy Orbison gets one. And then Tom Petty gets the kind of like intros to the chorus.
And in the music video, which is excellent, they're on a train just playing, perfectly matches the aesthetic they were going for.
It's kind of like the Hobo Stowaway aesthetic, almost.
Yeah.
Kind of like a jug band.
Yeah.
It's great.
Kind of makes you a little emotional because the music video was made after the song was recorded. So yep. Roy Orbison's on this track, but Roy Orbison's on the music video. So what they do is they put a guitar in a rocking chair and they also cut to his picture. Mm-hmm. When his part comes up, it's pretty beautiful. It kind of makes me tear up a little bit right now, just the impact of it. Because like this is much like Handled with Care, just like kind of captures exactly what this whole experience is. And I think it's great. And if you've never heard this song, go out of your way to listen to this. Like I'm just so blown away by how good of a song this is.
Is it safe to say you like this more than Handle with Care?
Yes, I think so. How do you feel about it?
I think they're both bangers. I think they're both great, great songs. I think it would depend on the day for me. They're both truly excellent, and it's really hard for me to mm-hmm. pick a favorite between the two.
Mm-hmm. Like I said, everybody kind of gets to contribute something interesting to this. Like you hear, even though we kind of said that Bob Dylan doesn't do the chorus stuff, but he does part come in with like where the end of the line,
yeah,
like those parts you do hear him, and then like the chorus where it's all right. Like everybody's interesting voice you get to hear sing that part. Like Jeff coming in is great. George's way of doing is great. Roy's way of doing it is great, and the way that they all combine towards the very end. This song also just has like a good momentum. It might be because of like weirdly the music video makes you think of trains, and it just kind of flows really well. And I think this was a song that when I heard it, I always re-listen to it at least one or two times when I hear it. It's definitely one that I'll keep with me. It's my favorite, even though in Weird Days in Volume 3, there is a song called Cool Dry Places, which I just think is like a really silly song that I like because it's about storing musical instruments. And I like the absurdity of that story.
So I've never listened to this song. It's about how to properly store your instruments.
But yeah, we'll talk about that when we talk about it. But yeah, this song is great. It's a great way of ending it. It's
as an album ender, which this originally was, like when it came out on vinyl, mm-hmm. it's really hard to do better than this.
If we were ever to do a tier list of this, this would definitely be in one of the highest tiers. And even though this, I think, End of Line would be in the highest tier, Handled with Care would be in the highest tier. This album as a whole, even though it's samey, it's a great experience. If you've never heard it, listen to it. Hopefully you have. You're following along with us like
our little book club.
And yeah, love this album. But speaking of which, our next album we're going, you know, we kind of been alluding to country. So we're going country. We're going to an album because some people said, we're old. We only cover things that people who are dead. Also, that is kind of sad to say that there are only two surviving members of the Traveling Wilburys at this point.
The fact that Bob Dylan out-survived Tom Petty baffles me, but, you know.
It's crazy. But we're going country. We're going to an album that came out only like in the last few months, and that is Ringo Starr's masterpiece, Look Up, where he goes full country.
We'll get to talk about how much we love Ringo. Ringo's long fascination with the country music genre, and get a primer mm-hmm. into what our background in country music is. It'll be a fun time.
It will be. And we are now about to leave you. What I want to say is if you're on a podcast platform, please subscribe to the podcast. And it would be great if you would leave reviews. Those really help us in the long run. It gets so people get the vibe of what this is. And also, if you listen to any of this on YouTube, like subscribe, bell, do all that other stuff as well. Like it, dislike it, doesn't matter. It feeds the algorithm anyways. And with that, do you have anything else to say to us before we completely say goodbye?
Appreciate you spending your time with us here. We will talk to you all mm-hmm. next time.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.